At a time when investors are confronted with market volatility and a variety of challenges fueled by the uncertainty of inflation, unsettled geopolitical tensions, and economic pressures, Luke Guerrero stands ready to take your finance and investment questions and share his unbiased answers. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. The clarity for your path forward starts now. Here is KPP Financial Portfolio Manager, Luke Guerrero.
Good afternoon, fellow investors. This is InvestTalk, and today is Friday, May 3rd, 2024, which means we made it through the first partial week of May and on to Friday, and hopefully we're going to have a very relaxing weekend. I know I intend to relax. I just moved last week, so it's good to have a weekend to myself and my girlfriend and my cats to just hang out and decompress, because really it's been an interesting week. It's been an exciting week. It's been in some ways, unexpected week of news. And we're going to touch on all of those things. We're going to talk about the market today, the market this week, what we can expect of the market going forward, as well as some stories that I found interesting that I think you would find interesting and informative as well. But most importantly, hopefully I get to hear from you live, because your finance and investment questions are what really drive the conversation forward and help us all on our journey to become a better investor. Now, before we do all that, we're going to answer our first caller question that came in earlier to 888-99-CHART.
Hello, InvestTalk. I'm calling about the ticker symbol RVND. I see it's been growing like crazy in the last month, but I see no earnings, only news about a future drug for cancer. I would like to know your opinion looking forward, if you think this is a stock that can go over 40 or it's just simply overbought and it's about to go down. Thank you.
So the question was about ticker ABNB, which is Airbnb. And for those of you who don't know, though I imagine most of you do, Airbnb is a vacation and temporary rental company. They're part of the gig economy, so people who own properties can go on Airbnb and they can rent their properties to customers, either for their vacations, for short-term rentals, or even longer-term leases in some cases. And so the thing about Airbnb, in my opinion, before we dig into the fundamentals, is from an anecdotal perspective, I used to love Airbnb, because when it first started, Airbnb tended to be a cheaper alternative in especially big cities rather than staying in hotels. Now it seems to me like the costs of hotels have generally gone down, and there's a lot of parity in cost, but really more of a service in hotels. You have maids, cleaning staff, so on and so forth. And so when you see from a macro environment perspective, a lot of issues within real estate, and the company itself doesn't own the real estate, right? It has those contractors, those individuals, meaning that the owners of those homes have varying financial situations. And when things start to compress a little bit, when margins start to compress, maybe they can't afford those homes. So that's one bad thing Airbnb has going for it. Now, taking a look at fundamentals, they've had some decent revenue growth over the past 5 years, and their price performance has been relatively in line with their industry. Now, their cash flow has been okay and has been slightly improving, but it tapered off more recently. And a lot of that came to a head in Q1 when their guidance said that they kind of had a bad outlook for the year. Why was that? Well, a lot of that had to do with dwindling consumer finances. A lot of people don't have the discretionary spending they had coming out of the pandemic. You kind of see a big boom in terms of revenue for this company in 2022 and 2023. A lot of people had a lot of money to spend. Now they're projected to make more money this year, and we'll hear, you know, what we expect from the company for the rest of 2024 in a couple days in May. So to me, I think this company is a little overbought. If you look at a relative valuation perspective, it's trading at a forward-looking PDE of 34, which is still well below where it's been over the past 5 years. This has really been a story of a company that didn't make a lot of money or really any money at first. And there were a lot of growth dynamics that people were hoping for. And some of that came to fruition, but still, you know, I think there's a lot going against Airbnb in terms of the macro environment, but also from a, is it a good value proposition prospect in terms of me purchasing it right now, given what I would expect growth to be tapering off over the next couple years as parity, like I said, between hotels and vacation rentals tends to, or has been collapsing a little bit. I would stay out of this for now. I think it's overbought. I think people are taking position before earnings. And it'll be interesting to see what they say in a couple days in terms of forward-looking guidance. But for now, I would not recommend getting into Airbnb. Thanks for the call. Now, we got a lot of ground to cover in the next 45 minutes or so, and here's some of what we have planned for you, time permitting. Our main focus point concerns this question: why hundreds of U.S. banks may be at risk of failure. One expert says that the most at-risk banks aren't insolvent or even close to insolvent, they're just stressed. So we'll drill down into this story and talk about bank failures historically, economic stress, what that means, and some protective measures in case of bank failures. Also, we'll be talking about the weaker U.S. jobs data and what that could mean going forward for the Fed's ability to cut rates this year, one time, multiple times, or if it means that they're going to potentially have a higher chance of raising rates in the foreseeable future. We'll also talk a little about geopolitics and how that's really taken a central role in not just how the country is moving, but how individual businesses are moving. We've been talking about reshoring, onshoring, friendshoring for some time, and now a lot of it's happening in practice. And should we have some time at the end of the show, we'll talk about Russian gas, where it's been, where it is now in the wake of the Ukraine war and decreased demand for Russian gas coming out of Europe, and what that means for its prospects going forward in a new world. We also have some voice bank questions ready to play, including one on GT, which is Goodyear Tire and Rubber, and CVS, CVS Health Corp. Also have some questions that came in from the comment section of our InvestTalk YouTube channel. We like to get to those when people leave comments. And since it's Friday, we'll also share some highlights from the newest KPP Premium newsletter. And of course, I welcome your finance and investment questions now or anytime throughout the show on 888-99-CHART. Now we're going into a short break, and on the other side, I'll talk about today's market activity and take your questions on the InvestTalk Anytime listener line.
InvestTalk callers make each podcast unique.
I was calling about Intel, if it's worth holding on to, or should I sell it?
Their questions are curious.
Hello. I have saved up around $80,000, and I was wondering what I should do to make it grow.
Careful.
Oh, I'm just wondering, is this a value trap? Because it looks like it's gone down quite a bit.
Concerned.
It's taken quite the tumble today. I've been trying to get out of this position for a while. I think I waited too long.
And clever.
It does seem to be situated in some areas of expanding population.
And Justin Klein, Steve Peasley, and now Luke Guerrero are always ready with their unbiased answers.
And this is, it looks like a classic example of chasing yield. Don't chase the yield.
Next 12 months price to earnings is around 30. I just don't see it at this price.
Don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART. You've got finance and investment questions, and Luke Guerrero is here taking your calls live. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
As promised, let's talk a little bit about the market today and this week. U.S. equities finished higher in trading today, with major indices ending the week overall higher after some consecutive weeks of a slump. A lot of that was driven by big tech, which was broadly higher on the back of Apple, which was a notable gainer, up, I believe, over 6-7% on the wake of the news of a big share buyback coming. Other outperformers included home builders, biotech names, media companies. Some of the underperforming names were names that have been doing well for quite some time: energy, cybersecurity, large cap pharma, and healthcare. Overall, I would say it was more of a risk-on session, and a lot of that pull came from a forward of easing expectations of Fed rate cuts, right? So as of last week, a lot of the sentiment was that maybe they won't cut it all this year. Maybe the earliest they'll cut is November. Well, now the market, after this jobs report, is pricing in potentially a cut in September. And so, like I said, that's driven by this bad news is good news dynamic, where anytime you see the economy is deteriorating a little bit, that leaves the Fed room to cut, should that also lead to disinflation. And so we had the jobs report, we had the ISM services number, April payrolls, which we will talk about a little bit later, coming in at 175,000, which was the lowest since October. And the unemployment rate ticked up slightly, while average hourly earnings of 0.2% were cooler than expected. Looking back on a bullish versus bearish narrative, it was a pretty good day for the bulls. There was some rate reprieve, a higher bar for tightening, as Powell said that he doesn't think that the next policy move is going to be a rate hike. And also from the Fed comments, which may have been lesser caught, was QT tapering, quantitative tightening tapering, being more aggressive than expected, with the monthly treasury runoff to be capped at $25 billion. Also JOLTS, which we mentioned, job openings, lowest since February 2021. And overall, Q1 earnings have beat metrics. The 2024 consensus has actually moved a little bit higher since the start of the year, something that many people didn't think was possible. From a bearish perspective, there's a little bit more talking about stagflation. Although it could be good from a rate cut perspective that April ISM manufacturing and services fell into contractionary territory, that is bad from an economic perspective. Remember, it's good news in terms of rate cuts, but it still is bad news. There were sticky inflation worries as well. Consumer confidence fell to its lowest level in nearly 2 years. And the FOMC statement flagged lack of further progress on inflation in recent months. Looking forward to next week, there's really not much going on in terms of market moving data releases, wholesale inventories and consumer credit come out on top of mind. But, you know, the week after that, PPI is released, CPI is released. So we'll see if what we're seeing in this jobs data is evident in terms of keeping a disinflationary narrative and maybe allowing the Fed room to begin to cut rates towards the ends of this year and maybe price out the fact that they may have to raise rates at some point. And that's the market today. Now, I hope you've been telling your friends and our InvestTalk audio podcast is also posted on video form on our YouTube channel. And it seems that every day now we receive finance and investment questions from the comment section of our InvestTalk YouTube channel. Here's one that came in yesterday about CSWI. And the question is, can I get your thoughts on CSWI stock? So CSWI is CSW Industries. I feel like I've said those letters many times. And, you know, it's a industrial company that kind of operates within three different areas. Their contract solutions is the company's core business. That's about 67%, which you can see here, of their revenue. And what that does is it manufactures products for residential and commercial properties, notably its HVAC systems and plumbing applications. It also has a specialized reliability solutions unit, which provides tools to improve on performing of industrial assets, and an R&D department within their engineered building solutions, which really helps small businesses with construction and modernizing buildings overall. And so taking a look at this company, it's had a pretty good track record in terms of price performance. It actually spun off in 2015 from Capital Southwest Corporation, but it's had quite the run-up. And so you actually see its price right now is well above the target price of analyst averages. And it's because sales growth has been pretty phenomenal. 18.4% over the past 5 years in terms of sales growth, which for a small cap company, you know, it's on the higher end of small caps, it's nearly $4 billion company. It's still pretty impressive. And because of that, year to date, they're up 17%. They've beat their industry by 20% on average over the past 5 years. That's pretty significant. Pulling up some cash flow and debt numbers here. But if you look here, their long-term debt, not bad. $308 million on a $4 billion company. That's not bad at all. Their free cash flow has been improving. Their return on equity has gone up as well over the past 5 years. It's kind of moderated between 17 and 14, but it was 19 last year. It's projected to be a little bit lower this year, but input costs are rising. That makes sense. Its relative strength is high. Its cash flow, like I said, has been improving over the past couple of years. Profitability looks good. This is a very well-run company, but it's not good enough to be a well-run company, right? It has to be a well-run company at a good price. And for an industrial company to justify this kind of growth going forward, to get to a 30 times price to earnings, that seems unlikely to me. Now, they're going to report earnings. I believe it might be their fiscal year end. Yeah, their fiscal year end for 2024 earnings comes in on May. 22nd. So there's some time people are taking some positions, maybe hoping that that revenue growth that they expected manifests itself, especially in a time where you would expect during, because of input costs, profitability to shrink, which is what is expected. But it's a good business. I think it's a fine business to own for the long term. I just don't think right now, given its elevated valuation, especially for an industrial company, this isn't a growth tech name, I'm not sure they can sustain this level of growth over this 5-year annualized growth over the long term. That's pretty significant growth. I would wait until the price comes down a little bit. I'd even wait till after earnings, see what their outlook looks like for the next year, see if they actually met their revenue projections. A lot of small cap companies haven't been able to do that, where large cap companies have done well this year. A lot of that outsized earnings growth has been on the top half of the market. So for me, this is a keep on your watch list. Wait and see. Don't buy it just yet. Now it's Friday and we're moving into a break. So I hope to hear from you over the next 40 minutes, anytime at 888-99-CHART.
Luke Guerrero is here and ready to tackle your questions.
Is it a good idea to sell your losses in a Roth IRA and just use whatever you have left to reinvest into better stocks?
Just wanted to ask you about one stock that I'm looking at, Entergy ETR.
Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Let's take a quick look at your financial to-do list. At the top, make that phone call to the InvestTalk Anytime listener line. 888-99-CHART.
Now, someone listened, and we got a live call from Ohio. Dave, you have a question about Starbucks. Is that correct?
Yes. It's at a 52-week low, and what your thoughts on the company, and what price would you get in?
Yeah, well, from a product perspective, I don't like the coffee. I think it's a little bit overpriced, and given where the revenue has gone based on their announcement on Tuesday, it looks like a lot of people are pulling back. Consumers have been depleting some of their savings. And one of the easiest ways to cut back is on expensive items that aren't necessities. And I make coffee at home. Always have. I think it's better. A lot of people like Starbucks. So deep within this report, though, I think there are two important notes. One is that the consumer is pulling back a little bit. And it's not just Starbucks. McDonald's also reported the same thing. So there's evidence all over the place. The second one is Starbucks has a lot to do in terms of innovating, because not only are consumers pulling back, one of the most interesting parts of their report was that the most heavily trafficked areas in the morning, they actually have a higher number of customers than they've ever had start orders, look at the wait times, and then not finish those orders. So they have a customer base out there, but they're not able to efficiently capitalize on that. And so with that two-pronged attack on their revenue, I think they have a lot to figure out, and it's going to be costly. Since Tuesday, the price has dropped off pretty significantly. It's down to a forward-looking PDE of 19, which is more reasonable than it's been in some time. Its five-year average is 28. But its cash flow has been falling. Its profitability has been falling. Its debt load is fine. It's $24 billion on $84 billion, and it's not highly levered at all. Most of that is long-term debt. But I think this probably has a little bit more room to run downward. And that's because even if they finish the operational efficiency thing, which they can certainly fix, and it's important that they fix, because the morning power hour, their coffee forward hour, they call it, is the most important time in their business. It's those 3 hours in the morning when people order coffee. And they can fix that. But I think one of the things that might hinder them going forward is just consumer spending. And you saw it in the most recent consumer sentiment surveys. People are dwindling their savings downwards. So I think Starbucks may continue to fall. I think a lot of these discretionary retail names may continue to fall as well. So I wouldn't pick it up just yet. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Now let's shift gears back over to my main focus point today, which concerns this topic. And that's why hundreds of U.S. banks may be at risk of failure. One expert says that most at-risk banks aren't insolvent or even close to insolvent. They're just stressed. So let's drill down a little bit into what a bank failure is, what those economic stresses might be, and some protective measures that are already in place should banks fall. And so really it's these pressures that are facing hundreds of small and regional banks across the U.S. And in a way, this echoes historical patterns of financial stress that have sometimes led to bank failures. Discussion's particularly relevant as we think about how economic fluctuations and stress and really policy decisions, not just the Fed or monetary policy, but fiscal regulatory decisions, impact these institutions. Historically, most of the worst economic crises have been in the shadow of bank failures that have haunted the financial system. There's been periods of pretty significant bank distress that have shaped our economic policies and financial regulations, most notably recently in 2008, where excessive risk-taking by banks, especially in real estate, led to a cascade of failures and significant government intervention that we still feel today. In the Great Depression in the 1930s, when thousands of banks failed, the government created the FDIC to insure deposits. So fast forwarding to today, according to analysis by a consulting firm called Claros Group, about 282 banks are currently facing the dual threat of exposure to commercial real estate loans and potential losses due to higher interest rates. Most of these institutions are smaller lenders, assets under $10 billion, which makes them even more vulnerable to these shifts in economic climate, and more importantly, outside of the tougher regulatory regime of the Fed, given their size. And so while these banks are not necessarily on the brink of insolvency, their stress is still significant enough to potentially restrict their growth and investment in new technologies, branches, staff, but more importantly, investment in communities. Fitch Ratings warned that some of these banks might fail or even struggle to meet their minimum capital requirements, which were set in the wake of 2008. Now, given where these banks are and who their deposit base is, the situation poses risks not just to the bank, but also to the communities they serve. For individual depositors, it's not that big of a deal. You have to wait a little bit to get your money, but the immediate risk of bank failures are somewhat mitigated by the FDIC because they insure deposits up to $250,000. So for most, there's no direct consequences if their funds are within these insured limits. So how else does it affect stakeholders? Well, most local community development, most local businesses, local farms, mom and pop stores, it's financed by these small banks on Main Street, not those big banks on Wall Street. You don't go to JP Morgan Chase if you want a small business loan most of the time. You go to your credit union. You go to your local bank, your regional bank. And so the current stress among small and regional banks kind of highlights the crucial aspect of financial stability that a lot of people don't talk about. And it kind of underscores the importance of prudent risk management, not just from these banks, but from you as well, and understanding that widespread bank failures have historically led to the most severe of economic downturns. Now, in the next Invest Talk, we'll look into this story. Job growth took a hit in April and unemployment rose. But that's for Monday. For now, I'm Luke Guerrero, and I'm ready to take your calls anytime at 888-99-CHART.
At this point, I think almost everyone has heard how generative AI promises to bring us to the next industrial revolution. AI is already shaping society with an impact on daily life that echoes the transformative significance of electricity or the internet. As we take steps to embrace the potential of generative AI, we need to remain vigilant with regard to its exploitability. This is where HackerOne comes in. HackerOne's AI Red Team addresses the novel challenges of AI safety and security for businesses that are launching new AI deployments. The HackerOne approach involves targeted offensive testing by harnessing the collective skills of ethical hackers who are proficient in AI and prompt hacking. In short, AI red teaming is the practice of stress testing AI models and deployments to make sure they can't be tricked into providing information beyond their intended use, and that security flaws can't be exploited to access confidential data or systems. HackerOne seamlessly integrates with your existing tools to enhance communication and collaboration across development, security, and IT teams. So, Stay ahead of the game in the battle against cyber threats with HackerOne's Attack Resistance platform. Learn more at HackerOne.com. That's HackerOne.com, HackerOne.com.
The more you learn about how the market works, the better your chances for success. So don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Justin. Hi, Leek. How are you? Hope you're doing well. I have a question regarding Goodyear Tires, symbol GT. I'm looking at their balance sheet and their cash flow. Their cash flow seems to be negative for the past couple quarters, and their cash and cash equivalent seems to be pretty flat as well. They are slowly paying out their debt, but I'm not sure if this is something that we should like run away on or just see how it goes. Looking forward to listening to your answer. Thank you.
So Goodyear Tire is, surprise, surprise, tire company. I think I have Goodyear tires in my car. And it has a lot of debt. Now, it may be paying down that debt, not that much. It looks like it paid down $300 million from 2022 to 2023. And so it's left with over $8 billion on a $3 billion market cap company. And it's highly levered. It's got an interest rate coverage ratio of 1.17, meaning it only earns enough money before interest and taxes to pay off its interest expense 1.17 times over. So if revenue falls too much, if profit margins compress too much, if input costs go up too much, they can't cover it. And in terms of earnings per share, they lost money last year. They're supposed to make money this year, about $1.28 a share. But the business has kind of been all over the place. And over the past 5 years, they have underperformed the industry by about 5%. And on top of all that, their revenue growth is only about 5%. And so their cash flow, which has been relatively stable in nominal dollar terms, not in real dollar terms. If you include inflation, it's been falling more significantly than it looks like if you're looking at a chart. Their profitability, again, all over the place, sometimes negative, sometimes positive. And their debt is incredibly high. And so here's an example of a company where you may think, oh, its forward-looking PDE is 8.4. It's price to book, less than one. You're paying less than the assets of the company. This must be a great value proposition. Not if they're not making money. Not if they're not growing the business. So for me, too much debt, not enough growth. I would stay away from Goodyear Tire. Thanks for the call. Now on Fridays, we generally make time to fit in a quick rundown of key benchmark numbers. So let me hit you with the list that we have for you now. The two-year treasury yield was at 4.81%. For perspective, 2 weeks ago, it was at 4.97. 11 weeks ago, it was at 4.66. And 123 weeks ago, more than 2 years, it was at 0.64. I did not misspeak. The 10-year treasury yield was 4.506. 2 weeks back, that was 4.615. 4 weeks ago, that was 4.373. And 120 weeks ago, that was 1.762. Gold was priced at $2,300 per ounce today. 2 weeks ago, it was $2,395. 7 weeks back, it was $2,156, and 114 weeks ago, it was $1,806. Silver was at $2,645 per ounce. 2 weeks back, it was $2,794. 7 weeks back, it was $2,518, and 109 weeks ago, $2,394. Oil was selling for $78.34 per barrel today. 2 weeks back, it was $83.10. 4 weeks back, it was $87.25. And 104 weeks ago, $97. The national average for a gallon of regular gasoline is $3.66 per gallon. 7 weeks back, it was $3.43. 48 weeks back, it was $4.56. And 116 weeks ago, $3.57. But in California, it was averaging $5.36 per gallon today. 7 weeks back, that number was $4.88. 12 weeks ago, it was $4.48. And 103 weeks ago, it was $5.87. For comparison, in New Mexico today, gas was averaging $3.30 per gallon. That is $2.06 less per gallon than in the state of California. Now let's shift over to the KPP Premium newsletter, which was finished today, and it will be distributed to subscribers tomorrow morning. But today, we have a preview for you guys. In the market conditions section, we explain that the U.S. labor market's recent performance has presented a nuanced picture, offering a mix of both promising and cautionary signals for the economy. April's jobs report indicated a slowdown with only 175,000 jobs added, well below the robust figures seen in prior months and underperforming against expectations. This deceleration could suggest that the labor market is reaching a more sustainable pace of growth, aligning with the Federal Reserve's aims to cool the economy without triggering a significant uptake in unemployment. With this modest rise in the unemployment rate to 3.9% and wages growing less than anticipated, inflationary pressures might see a slight easing. Providing the Fed more room to maneuver its monetary policy without aggressive rate hikes. Despite these softer labor market figures, the broader implications for financial markets are mixed. Equity markets especially have reacted to the Federal Reserve signals and the latest job growth data. Looking forward, the sector-specific outlook suggests that small caps may continue to face challenges unless there's more definitive action from the Fed regarding rate cuts. The current earnings projections for those stocks are not promising, with an anticipated decline of 8.4% in earnings growth for the recent quarter, in contrast to the S&P 500's expected growth of 10.2%. While recent labor market adjustments offer a glimmer of hope for an easing policy environment, the path forward remains fraught with challenges, and investors would do well to remain vigilant, focusing on sectors and stocks that are better positioned to withstand an extended period of elevated interest rates. There's a lot more commentary detail in the newsletter. But in the stock ideas section, we highlighted an enterprise-oriented company specializing in software platforms for counterterrorism investigations and related operations globally. In February, this company's stock surged 30.8% after beating Wall Street revenues estimates for Q4 2023. Despite their government-centric history, the company experienced a 70% growth in commercial sales in Q4 2023. And we also looked at a corporation that manufactures and markets comprehensive lines of residential and commercial gas tankless, and electric water heaters. It is a leading company in its sector with a reliable business model, ensuring consistent dividend increases regardless of economic cycles. It's currently trading around above what we see as their fair value at this time. Keep this name on your watch list, but we name names only in the newsletter, so subscribe anytime at investtalk.com. Looks like we have another caller who called in live. Richard, you have a question about GDX. Do you own it or are you looking to buy it?
I don't own it. And my question is mainly about like the relationship between gold and the gold miners and GDX in general. Like I look at Newmont and GDX and they're nowhere near their all-time high, but gold is surpassed the all-time highs by miles. So what is the cause behind this dissociation between the gold and gold miner prices? And does it mean that that gold miners are now like a good deal?
Well, that's a great question. So it's twofold. So the reason why you invest in miners is primarily because it smooths the volatility while exposing you to the asset. Because commodities tend to be way more volatile than companies, because when commodity prices are down, companies can reduce costs, they can lay off employees, reduce overhead, and smooth that experience. So it's not a pure play on the commodity because there's a lot more that goes into the business itself than just the price of gold. Now, there's actually a second layer to that as well. And that is this ETF and most ETFs are made up of a lot of companies. And not all of the companies in this ETF derive 100% of the revenue from gold. Some of them mine copper, they mine iron, they mine all sorts of things, uranium. It may be a smaller part of their business, but it's still a part of their business to make a significant contribution to their revenues. And so they'll be driven by those prices as well. So most of the time, you'll tend to see the trend of where these prices are going to match each other. But just because the commodity itself is at an all-time high doesn't mean the company whose primary source of revenue, again, primary, not only, is going to be at an all-time high as well. Thanks for the call. Now let's shift gears back to an interesting story that we kind of highlighted a little bit already today, and that is the jobs data. So looking at the latest jobs data that was released today, there's been some relief provided to Federal Reserve officials amid ongoing concerns that the economy might overheat. And so the April report showed a notable, pretty notable cooling in wage growth and hiring pace that really shifted things back to align more with the pre-pandemic levels into what could be a more sustainable level, which should in turn potentially ease inflationary pressures. In the month of April, the economy added, as we mentioned before, 175,000 jobs, which was the smallest gain since 2023. But the annual change in average hourly earnings dropped to 3.9%, which is also the lowest since May 2021. This means that wage growth is moving closer to the mid 3% range that the Fed targets, because that's what they believe is consistent with their 2% price inflationary target. And so the reaction from the Fed was pretty good. Austin Goolsbee, Chicago Fed president, said that it was a solid report in terms of job numbers and expressed some optimism. Fed Governor Michelle Bowman, who's known for her firm stance on controlling inflation, stated that she expects inflation to decline further if the policy rate remains steady. Note, she didn't say we're cutting. Both of them hinted that for now we stay the course. Now, despite, and I guess this has been the case for some time at this point, despite what the Fed is saying, traders are having a different opinion. And so now they're increasingly betting on a rate cut by the Fed, with expectations of a reduction coming as early as September, followed by even another one in December, all off of one report. Now, beyond today's report, Fed Chair Powell also had some words in his post-meeting press conference, pointed out two various indicators suggesting that the labor market is beginning to align better with the hiring demands of employers and available workforce, namely the data on job openings, rate at which workers are quitting, quits rate, and the pace of hiring overall. It's more in line with a sustainable rate. Still, even though it did come under consensus, under expectation, jobs growth last month was still close to the average seen in the decade before the pandemic. Again, a more sustainable level. Even more so, it was above the level needed to accommodate population growth. So, in essence, while the jobless rate ticked up slightly to 3.9%, it still remains below the 4.1% figure that the Fed officials see as aligned with their inflationary target, but also full employment. So, you know, overall, the overall picture is one of an economy that's managing to grow steadily without overheating, surprisingly, even to myself, providing some optimism that the Fed might manage to tame inflation effectively. Now, for investors and for market watchers, and probably for those traders as well, these developments are an important indication of where Fed policy is going. But you should remember, the Fed likes to say it meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, and anytime they can, they are, and we need to be, data dependent. Now let's shift back to our InvestTalk YouTube channel questions. And one came in earlier about showing the screen we use to analyze stocks, something which people seem to like. It says, I like how y'all have started showing the screen you use to analyze stocks, but do you think there would be any interest in showing a portfolio review? You would have to get consent, of course, but I feel like that would be interesting to see your process. That's an interesting question. Now, I would say that's important on complicated on two fronts. One is, we would never ask somebody to share their personal portfolio with the world for many reasons. One, you could accidentally get some sensitive information. Two, it's some of the most private things that investors have, right? Some of those private things we have, our financial situation. So I don't think that necessarily sharing a live portfolio review may be the route we want to go down. My second point is, portfolio reviews are no commitment. You can talk to myself or Justin, and we can give you our opinion on your portfolio, where it's lacking, where you're doing well, and it's free. So if you want to see an example of a portfolio review, come and do one yourself. It doesn't cost any money. It costs you a little bit of time. But we'll sit down with you, talk about your portfolio, see where you can improve. We'll have a discussion. Now, if we want to do an example of that, maybe we'll do a mock one at some point in the near future. But in terms of doing a live one, recording it, It may be interesting to some, but I just don't think it would be right to try and impress upon somebody that they should get their financial information accessible and available to all investors. But please reach out if you're interested in having one yourself. Now let's grab one more quick voice bank question right now.
Hey guys, assuming a scenario of lower rates, does that help the REIT market? I'm considering adding some more REIT exposure in my Roth IRA, possibly VG properties or maybe a self-storage REIT. All right, thanks.
You named two of the types of REITs that I like. I love self-storage REITs. I've said it over and over again. It's one of those things that people buy. It's a subscription service. People go into storage units, not me because I hate them. I think I don't like them. But a lot of people go in, they store their stuff, and they leave it there because the barrier to get it out is they have to move it, and they don't want to. So storage REITs are good. Entertainment REITs, gambling REITs tend to be good. Office REITs, commercial REITs, not the place to be right now. But the question was, would lower interest rates help REITs? Yes. REITs primarily operate in debt financing. So lower interest rates will help them. It will make more cash available to end investors. That will in turn help prices. But you don't just have to have low interest rates to help REITs. A certain path will help as well. So it's not about getting interest rates down to the low level, the terminal low level where they will be at going forward. It's about having certainty about rates that will help REITs as well. Now, this is InvestTalk, and I'm Luke Guerrero, and we have one goal here, and that is to help you achieve financial freedom. And our work continues after this break, so get your questions in now to 888-99-CHART.
I would like to know more about a company which I've been tracking for some time.
Luke Guerrero is here and ready to tackle your questions.
And I was just wondering, are there any investment accounts with different banks that you would recommend, something that may offer good resources?
Don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Every investor is working to build a secure financial future. How they get there and when they get there, that depends on many variables. The more you learn about how the market works, the better your chances. So don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Hi, InvestTalk. Thank you so much for the show. Steve from Minnesota. Quick question about CVS. Based on the most recent earnings, took a dive and is being re-rated by a lot of analysts. I mean, it looks a lot worse than I thought the numbers looked. I mean, they certainly missed, but I thought the earnings were an increase year over year. Didn't look as bad as the price action and the analyst downgrades are suggesting. So curious to hear your take. Thanks for all you do. Bye.
So CVS is a health company, right? They have stores, they provide insurance. And recently, their stock took a little tank after earnings came out. And that is because there was lower than expected growth and lower than expected revenues. And a lot of that was driven by the Medicare Advantage adjusted operating income, which came down 60% year over year. And in part because increased utilization. And so I think that most of the repricing to me probably seems to be near done. But the worry is in that the increased utilization could further drag down revenues going forward. And because of that, you see in a lot of analysts repricing. So, you know, year to date, they're down about 30%. Healthcare names have not been doing well over the past couple weeks. Their cash flow's been falling. Their profitability's been pretty flat. They have a decent amount of debt. They got about $79 billion on a $69 billion market cap company. And their earnings projections going forward and forward-looking guidance didn't look great. So could now be a good time to buy in? I mean, from a relative valuation perspective, like it's cheaper than it's been in some time. Its forward-looking PD is 7. But I just think there's a lot of uncertainty in what's been dragging those revenues down, and that is the increased utilization and what's been going on with the Medicare Advantage plans. So I would stay away from CVS for now. Thanks for the call. Now, before we head off for the weekend, I want to just touch briefly on a complex situation that I think Justin and I have been talking about some time. And so let's give you an anecdote I read about Marcus Group. And Marcus Group is facing what a lot of businesses are facing. And that is the question of, maybe not this specifically, this company is saying, where do we need to build our mechanized attic lift? And that decision is more complicated than you might think, because geopolitics is taking more and more of a role in that. Because a decade ago, the answer is easy, China. It was the go-to. They had abundant resources, steel, computerized machinery, semiconductors, everything you needed to build this lift. But today the landscape's shifting dramatically. And a lot of that is because U.S. and Chinese relations are deteriorating. There's potential for new tariffs on the horizon, tensions over Taiwan, over their support for Russia. And so faced with these uncertainties, Marcus Group and many companies are considering alternatives. So where is this leading them? Well, a lot of them are being led to Eastern Europe, which has higher labor costs, higher material costs, and sometimes more challenging logistics. But the lower geopolitical risks make them attractive. And many companies are rethinking their supply chains, as they should be, in response to a pandemic from a couple years ago, if you recall, and geopolitical tensions, trade wars. And so the recent expansion of Western tariffs and import restrictions on goods from China, along with other geopolitical risks, think the Houthi attacks on commercial shipping that closed off the Suez Canal, are prompting this major reevaluation, because companies are now dealing with not just rising tensions between countries, but stateless actors causing longer lead times and higher shipping costs. Container ships are taking lengthier, more expensive routes. Input costs are more expensive, which means output costs, the prices that we pay, are going to be more expensive. The shift is pushing some companies to switch to pricier air freight to minimize these delays. The trade environment is growing increasingly complex. And so overall, these shifts in global trade and manufacturing strategies kind of reflect this new reality we've been talking about for some time, where businesses have to navigate geopolitical and economic challenges, but have an eye towards maintaining stability and growth regardless of the cost. So, you know, in an increasingly hostile and complex world, supply chains probably need to be moved to more friendly areas. Now, I'm Luke Guerrero, and this completes another InvestTalk program. We thank you for listening, and we encourage you to tell your friends and family members about our free podcast downloads. Get yours anytime at iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. And please be sure to rate and review us on iTunes, as well as listen to, or rather watching, our InvestTalk podcast, which is now in video format on our YouTube channel. Just search InvestTalk, and don't forget, that's with two T's. Independent thinking, shared success. This is InvestTalk. Enjoy your weekend.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm, which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Steve Peasley is president, and Justin Klein is chief executive officer of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.